So I guess, okay, so my name is Natalie Corito. I'm a member of Quiet. I've been a member of Quiet since 2009. For those of you who don't know, Quiet is the group Queers Against Israeli Apartheid that formed in 2008. So I suspect that a lot of you are probably pretty familiar with Quiet and the work that we've done, and particularly our very dramatic relationship to Pride Toronto and city councilor, to Rob Ford, to a whole slew of lobbyists here in Toronto and internationally. So, you know, I mean, I'm just gonna move this aside, it's a little awkward. So, you know, I don't wanna necessarily rehash completely the details of the group, because I think context specific, you know, most of you who are probably from Toronto probably know quite a bit about Quiet already. In fact, you probably could inform, you could probably say more about it than I could in some ways, because I'm so invested in it that it's hard to get perspective sometimes. Just to kind of give the spiel a little bit, Quiet is like a solidarity group. We organize in solidarity with queer Palestinian activists in the region, but also we are in solidarity with larger Palestine solidarity movements, and you know, we are part of the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until they comply with international law. So, so the kind of focus of my talk is going to be to try and bridge some of the ways that the work that Quiet does has with broader questions around borders and in particular the relationship that queers have to the state. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, this idea of homo nationalism, which I'm sure a lot of you are really familiar with. Maybe some of you already hate the term. Maybe others find it completely confusing and unuseful, but it's actually kind of a concept that's at the base of a lot of the work that Quiet does. So I'm gonna, I guess, kind of give a little bit of a contextualization for what homonationalism means for the work that we do in Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, and connect it to the kind of other questions around organizing, because I think that'll make most sense for the panel in that respect. So I know I can talk a lot about Pride and our strategies around what we organized with Pride, but I'm gonna try and avoid most of that conversation just for tonight, unless you guys wanna talk about it. In which case, you know, I'll indulge. So, you know, Quiet is about responding also to Israel's use of gay rights and its justification of its continued occupation and apartheid system. We're also interested in building and contributing to queer communities in Toronto, particularly engaging in kind of radical queer politics, which we've seen like a huge surge in the last few years. I'm, you know, really impressed and excited to be in a city where so many people are taking a stand and speaking up around the terms and conditions of, you know, of the queer community in some form. You know, and Quiet has a kind of complicated relationship to Pride. So I'm just gonna go right into it and talk about homonationalism. How many of you, can I just get a sense, how many of you like have heard the word homonationalism before? Okay. How many of you have like read about it, understand kind of basically what it is? And get it. Okay, so like maybe like 3/4 of the people who raised their hands, all right. And Niles is shaking his head. I know that he knows what it means, but he's shaking his head like he doesn't. Okay, so basically, the idea of homonationalism is kind of like an academic idea, but it's very simple, and it's very useful for activists to use, because it helps us draw attention and bring focus to a whole bunch of ways that the state and the language on gay rights and gay rights struggles work together in very messy and unuseful ways for activism more generally, and especially for kind of solidarity activism, if you want to think about it in those terms. So, so the idea of homonationalism builds on this idea of homonormativity, which is basically that, you know, that as, you know, gay rights struggles, you know, began to be fought through the gay rights movement, those struggles got translated into claims, you know, against, you know, shifted from claims for justice to desires for inclusion within the state. So to be able to have access to gay marriage, to be able to fight in the military, gays in the military, ideas around like normative reproduction, having the right to, you know, adopt children, as well as, you know, kind of citizenship rights around in late capitalism. So, you know, the right to have gay dollars and have to become, you know, consumer citizens of Western democracies became important terrains that the language of gay rights translated into in the last 20 years. So we saw less and less struggles against the state and more struggles in at least a popular discourse in like media, portrayed media, to be included in the state. So homo nationalism builds on this idea around the inclusion of some gays into the state. So where was I? Yeah, so it's this idea of, you know, like a liberal kind of gay subject, liberal gay rights and inclusion within the state. But in particular, it's kind of like a bit of a reverse function in which the state uses this relationship of inclusion as evidence of its status as a liberal democracy. So, you know, the state, through the work of gay activists and queer rights activists, sexual rights activists, has, you know, certain laws now that protect queer subjects within Canada, for example, or in Israel. And the state turns around and says, oh look, you know, we are so great, we protect gay people. Gay people have rights because of us. So what does this do, this practice of homo nationalism? It does a couple things. So the first thing is that it kind of detracts attention away from the state's continued violation of human rights. And I think what Craig just talked about, I think, is a perfect example and explains exactly the ways in which those processes continue to happen in very violent ways often. It erases the way that homophobia, transphobia, and gender-based violence and oppression more generally are kind of persistent within the society, within Canadian society. It pretends like, oh, we live in like this really free place, and we can look at unfree places where people are attacked through homophobia, but then the daily experiences of people who face homophobia, as an example, are completely erased from like our popular discourses. We don't think about it. And you know, maybe the most insidious one is that it divides queers, and it invites some of them into the fold of the state at the expense of others, and it re-scripts the terms of justice. So we have, you know, gay marriage as the issue for sexual rights, and the achievement of gay marriage is a victory for all queer subjects, even the ones who have no investment in marriage and don't want to get married, and in fact, marriage becomes a structure that is actually itself oppressive in those moments. And you know, it imagines the state as kind of like the benefactor, the generous giver of rights, rather than reality that, you know, all rights are achieved through struggle, and that people struggle to fight for those rights, to make changes at the level of those institutions. And then, you know, it has this way of making reproduction a kind of the reproduction of an ideal national subject, you know, that's premised on a normative model of who the citizen should be. So who's a proper Canadian, and a proper Canadian looks a certain way, and a proper Canadian reproduces in a particular kind of way and makes a future citizen who will consume and shop and you know, maybe fight in a war for its national borders. Okay, so what does all this have to do with migrants, refugees, and people living under apartheid? So Israel and Canada both use and, I mean, maybe it's not even actively so in a purposeful way, but they take up in some way this idea of homo nationalism. And they use gay rights discourses to continue to marginalize and exclude non-status queer peoples, for example. There's a shift away from discussions around struggles for queers that have been part of our movements for since the beginning in many ways of queer movements, at least in Canada. And so, you know, suddenly the struggle for sexual rights doesn't include many conversations around HIV/AIDS anymore. And this is a particular kind of shift that services start getting cut. You know, we see criminalization of particular kinds of people with particular kinds of bodies. And then the tokenization of some queer subjects in a way that permits and gives permission to continue to exclude others. So if we want to talk about, you know, our immigration policies in Canada for refugee claimants, we see regularly the IRB, heroically taking on certain cases that are very palpable for a very conservative and sometimes even liberal audience to digest. So often we hear lauded by Jason Kenney that he is, fast-tracked the immigration processes for a refugee claimant coming from Iran because it's very convenient to demonize Iran as a country. Whereas, in the case of Alvaro, the fact that he doesn't look gay enough becomes the terms through which he's evicted from Canada, or attemptedly evicted from Canada. People are violated and humiliated and demoralized on a daily basis in Canada, for queer subjects. All that gets erased and, when we watch Will and Grace or, I guess that show's not on anymore, but I'm sure you've seen reruns. The condition of queers who live in precarious conditions, which are like, I think, the majority of queer people who face things like homelessness and experience domestic violence. There's a lack of services in Canada. We know it. Services are getting cut all the time. Questions of surveillance and police brutality. All right, so that's kind of like in Canada, and I'm sure these are all conversations I think that we've had. And in Israel, homonationalism gets used mostly on an international scale, right? So here in Canada, we hear a lot about how Israel is the only place in the Middle East where gay people are safe or protected. We hear a lot about how we have to defend Israel because, if you don't defend Israel, gay people will not have any rights at all in the Middle East. But what these kinds of narratives do is that they create a public PR persona, like a public relations image internationally. And a lot of that also erases the reality of what's happening within the borders of Israel. So Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza, for example, who have, in the last 10 years or so, fled to cities like Tel Aviv, don't have rights. They can't claim refugee status in those ways. The rights that are legally applied or that are legally exist within the Israeli constitution don't apply to Palestinians who don't have Israeli citizenship. A lot of these people face very similar conditions as they do in Canada when people are non-status, which means that they are often targeted by the police in Israel because, there's a military occupation and apartheid system. A lot of those people get blackmailed by the military or by the police and are threatened basically to be outed unless they provide information to the Israeli state. A lot of those people are living in really precarious conditions. And all of that is erased from those conversations every time someone says, but Israel's the only safe place for gays in the Middle East. So those people's bodies are actually physically erased from our imaginary when we enter into those arguments. and it also erases the kind of ways that, just because there's a law doesn't mean people live like free lives under those laws. In Canada, we have lots of laws that protect people in which, many people are not protected by them in the exercise of them on a daily basis. These arguments in general kind of play into Orientalism, the continuation of Orientalism, this idea that, the Middle East and the Arab world are backwards and evil and bad and homophobic, and the homophobia of the Middle East it gets used and translated in these kinds of moments to justify the continued use of violence by the state of Israel.